things just continued to escalate. His respiratory rate kept going up. His heart rate kept going up. His work of breathing was at this point just getting unsustainable. And we knew he was going to tucker out at some point and we were going to have to intubate.
Hey there. I'm your host, Sarah Lorenzini, a rapid response nurse and educator who loves telling stories to teach critical thinking. This podcast is for nurses who want the knowledge, skills, and confidence to respond to any emergency. With almost 20 years of experience in the ER and critical care nursing and a master's degree in nursing education, I have a lot of stories to share, and I love to nerd out and break down the pathophysiology, pharmacology, and nurses' role in emergencies. Stories bring learning to life. It is way easier to learn from and remember the stories that my colleagues and mentors have told me than anything I've read in a textbook. And that is why I made this podcast. Every episode is packed full of exactly what you need to know to handle whatever crisis that could arise on your shift. It's one thing to get the right answer on the test, but knowing how to detect when your patient is declining and what to do when your patient is crashing is what will make or break your day and might just save your patient's life. Hey there. Man, do I have a treat for you. You are about to meet Brooklyn. She's an ER nurse who messaged me with this crazy case, a patient she cared for, which for me would have been an absolute nightmare of a shift. This is such a good case that has so many great educational talking points. We're talking about the crashing asthmatic patient. No matter what she did, Brooklyn's patient just kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker. So, there's so much to talk about. This is part one of a two-part series on caring for the crashing asthmatic. So not just like take your albuterol and go home. This is the patient who becomes hemodynamically unstable and arrest from asthma. That's what we're talking about today. So if you're like, I would like to be prepared for the crashing asthmatic patient, well, come along with me in Brooklyn, hear all about her patient, and then next week we'll dive into all the details of how to manage this patient population. This is a really good one. You don't want to miss it. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Rapid Response RN podcast. Today, we're talking about what I consider to be a nightmare case. This is the kind of the patient that stays with you for your entire career. So to share this case with you, I have a special guest with me, Brooklyn. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yes, glad to have you too. So Brooklyn's an ER nurse and a podcast listener, and she messaged me on Instagram about this case. And I was like, oh my gosh, that sounds heart-wrenching and so very stressful, but also has so many opportunities for learning from it. So what I want to do today is, before we dive into Brooklyn's hell of a shift, Brooklyn, can you just introduce yourself? Like, tell everyone how long you've been a nurse and then what you love about ER nursing.
Sure. So I've been an ER nurse for about 4.5 years now. I started as a new grad in the ER, and I have worked at the same small community hospital ever since. I kind of worked my way up to be a triage nurse, a charge nurse. I've helped revamp our new grad program, and I also work as a SANE nurse in our ER.
I'm also a SANE nurse.
Awesome.
I enjoy it, but it's also, this is hard. This is hard, like
yeah.
heavy stuff to
yeah.
be a part of, but it's also so rewarding. All right. Let's talk about your patient. Can you just set the stage? Like, when you came on shift, what did you get in report?
So I was precepting that day. So me and my preceptee, we got report from the night shift nurse. We had a couple other patients. And then this one young guy, 23-year-old male, who was on BiPAP. He was having an asthma exacerbation. He was flu positive. And they had kind of done all the things throughout the early morning. NEBS, steroids, magnesium. And he ended up needing to be put on BiPAP. So we took over when he was kind of cruising on BiPAP.
And then, so besides the asthma history, any other history for him?
We didn't know it at the time, but he did have some underlying psychiatric history. Not like fully diagnosed, but on risperidone. That was his only other history.
Got you. So was he just like waiting for a bed in your PCU, or were they trying to get him discharged home? Like, what was the plan for him at that time?
So he was an ICU hold at that point. Our ICU, we didn't have any more beds open. So he was just going to be held until something opened up.
Gotcha. Okay. So looking like he's kind of compensating so far. What was his respiratory rate on the BiPAP?
He was still tachypneic. I think he was like in the high 20s, low 30s, like when we started with him.
Okay. So he seems to be doing okay. At what point was it like his asthma is getting difficult to manage? Where did he kind of like turn the corner there?
I mean, it was just like the whole day is every time we walked in the room, it's like, darn, he's a little worse. He's a little worse. Like just nothing was heading in the right direction, no matter what we did. Because we started off the day, gave him like back-to-back continuous NEBs because he was just inspiratory, expiratory, wheezing on the BiPAP and still a little bit tachypneic, but like speaking in full sentences. But then I think around like 9:30 in the morning, he started just getting agitated and anxious. And it was just hard to keep the BiPAP mask on. He kept wanting to take it off and then just taking it off. So that's, I suppose, when things really started getting worse.
All right. So he's like not complying with the BiPAP and like, kind of understandably so. Like you can't, it's like hard. You can't breathe, all those things strapped to your face and the positive pressure just feels weird. And he already has like the auto peep going on. Like I get that. So what did you guys do since he wasn't really keeping the mask on?
Initially we switched him to OptiFlow because he was just able to tolerate that better. And at least it was something. He started declining any of the continuous NEBs because he felt like his home MDI, like I don't know if it was kind of the placebo effect of that's what helps him at home. So that's what he wanted to use. So he wouldn't let us give us a continuous NEB. At least we could get the OptiFlow on him. Because with nothing on, he was desatting to the 80s. So I called his mom at that point and was like, hey, like, you know, he's having a real tough time. You know, he's a pretty young kid still. If any family wants to come support him, that might be helpful. And then at that point, that's when she tells me he does have some underlying psych history. He normally takes risperidone and maybe we should try that. She was like, great, let the doc know. We gave him some risperidone and we gave him a little Ativan too to see if we could kind of control his anxiety.
Good thinking. Like I love your thinking outside the box because we kind of like push anxiety to the side. Like the problem is his breathing, but they are so interconnected, right? If his anxiety gets out of control, then he's tachypneic and then the whole spiral happens. So that was really good. Like let's get the family in here to help support him. Okay. So did the family ever show up?
Yeah, mom came.
Okay. So family's on their way. You gave some Ativan. Did it help?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So that whole morning we were kind of just dancing between like, hey, let's try BiPAP again. It's really going to help you more. And then like back and forth between BiPAP and OptiFlow. And around 11:30 in the morning, we tried a ketamine infusion. One, because that helps a little bit with the bronchodilation. And two, because hopefully it was going to help with his anxiety and kind of help him relax.
Gotcha. So were you guys just doing like low dose ketamine, like in the background, or were you like trying to dissociate him with the ketamine?
It was like a 30-minute infusion.
Okay. So kind of like a very slow. Got it. All right. Any other stuff that you tried to like help him turn the corner?
I mean, we were any albuterol we could get in him. We were trying to.
Yeah, because he wouldn't take it. He was only doing his puffs.
Yeah, he didn't want the continuous, which is like a true dose that he actually needed.
Right.
So he was doing the puffs whenever he wanted to. And then throughout the morning, we had given him. He got IM epi and IM terbutaline at various points.
You guys literally pulled out like all the things from the toolbox.
Yeah.
So let's just review all the things you've done so far. You said albuterol, as much as you could get in him. You've tried ketamine. You've tried terbutaline. Have you guys done magnesium so far?
Yeah, he got magnesium like at the beginning.
A while back? Okay. What am I missing?
We ended up doing a second round of steroids because he had initially got methylprednisone at like 3 a.m. or something. And so then it was like noon. And that's when things just continued to escalate. His respiratory rate kept going up. His heart rate kept going up. His work of breathing was at this point just getting unsustainable. And we knew he was going to tucker out at some point and we were going to have to intubate, which we were really hoping to avoid.
And this is where it becomes like the nightmare case for me because I'm fine responding to stuff like, okay, you have this symptom. I got this for you. You have this symptom. I have this intervention for you. But when you've like done all the things and they're not turning the corner, that's when it becomes a little bit scary as the nurse. Okay. So you guys are literally doing all the things. At what point was it like, okay, it's time to intubate?
So up until that point, we had kept telling the patient like, you know, things are getting worse. We want you to use the BiPAP. We're worried we're going to have to intubate you. And he was like, no, don't intubate me. Like I'm refusing that. You guys can't intubate me. And then his mom's there and we're like, okay, we're going to try a Presidex drip, see if that can get him calm and get him to tolerate the BiPAP. And so we got him all set up in the room. We turned off the lights. Mom's there holding his hand. We're infusing this Presidex strip. And for like 20 minutes, it worked. And he was like calm. He was sitting well. His work of breathing was still increased, but more sustainable. And then I'm in like the room next door and I hear him like start talking loudly to his mom. I was like, oh no. So I go right back in there and he's taken off the BiPAP mask. And he's like standing there, like yelling. He's like, I can't do this. And I'm like, okay. Like here, just at least put the OptiFlow on. Like you just need some sort of oxygen. And so as we're like switching over to this OptiFlow mask, his eyes just like go wide. And his mom is like, oh no, something changed. And he just goes into like severe respiratory distress. And the last thing he says is, give me the tube. And so, yeah. Is like this thing came over him and he realized how bad his breathing was. So I put the OptiFlow mask on him. We sit him in the bed. He's tripodding. He's breathing like 70 and he's desatting even on the OptiFlow now. Run back out, tell the doc like, hey, you know, he totally decompensated. We're going to have to tube him now.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, this is like worst case scenario. We do not like to intubate as bad as we can avoid it.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about the intubation. How did it go?
The like getting the tube in part was real easy. I think we used Rock and Atomate, which are our go-tos in my ER. Tube went in just fine. And then we decided to start him on a propofol drip and we continued with the Presidex. And I've had the pleasure of intubating asthmatics before. And no, you want to be really aggressive with that sedation. So I was getting my propofol up as fast as they could so that he'd be nice and sedated on it. But things just continued on their downward spiral.
Okay. So hemodynamically, how did he do with the intubation? Did he have any blood pressure tank or did his heart rate go up through the roof or how did he tolerate it?
His blood pressure ended up going up post-intubation. But otherwise, we got his sats up right away with the ET tube. And I mean, his heart rate was just continually high. I think he was like 130, but it just continued to climb post-intubation. So BP and heart rate went up.
So how did he do after intubation? Did he just magically get better? Like, as if intubation ever does that for an asthmatic.
That's what we wanted, but no. He was super difficult to ventilate. So tube goes in. I got my stethoscope there, you know, listening to confirm placement for the doc. And like, you know, I put it on both sides of his chest and it's like, I hear nothing. So I'm like, okay, let me try up a little higher. And then I'm like, okay, I guess I'll try up higher. And I literally only heard like the squeakiest little breath sounds at the very apex of his lungs.
So you know, we're not ventilating. We have a tube in there, but we can't ventilate.
No, there was no room in there.
Yeah. Okay. So then what are you guys to do? Like, how do you ventilate someone who has no capacity to ventilate?
Yeah. So at that point, we had two RTs in there and they were basically like trying to manually bag the patient and there was so much resistance. So they were just doing kind of low and slow and basically we were trying a bunch of different methods. And right away we realized like this is really challenging. We're affiliated with a bigger hospital. So that's when we got them involved and we're like, hey, like we don't have room for him in our ICU anyway, but he might be out of our league as is. So we got a pulmonary critical care doctor on the phone to like help guide us as to what settings to try on the vent. So RT's in there. We're trying this. We're trying that. And I'm looking at his chest as, you know, they're changing the settings. And then we would take it off and bag him for a little bit. And his chest is just like shaking. Even rise and chest fall was not there. It was just chest shaking. So I call the doc in again, and now we're trying like manually decompressing his chest. So you disconnect it from the vent and the doctor just tries to like push the air out of his chest because it's so rigid.
This is like your last ditch effort to try to help this patient. Mm-hmm. All right, keep going. This is just getting like worse and worse and scarier.
All right. So now, yeah, he's been intubated for like an hour or two. We've tried a million different vent settings. The respiratory therapist never left the room. His heart rate's continuing to go up. It's in like the 160s now. His blood pressure's ridiculous. It's like 190. And we do this post-intubation ABG. And his pH was 6.9. And his CO2 was 160 post-intubation. And so then after we've done all of this manual decompressing and, you know, just worse, worse and worse. We did another AVG at like 4:30. And then his pH was 6.8 and his CO2 was 193. So like intubation has not helped.
Wrong direction.
Yeah. Intubation has not made anything better. Everything's just getting worse.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then suddenly I'm in the room. I never left that room. I'm like, I think I'm starting a nicardipine drip or something because his blood pressure went through the roof. And like, I'm looking at my cardiac monitor and all of a sudden I've got, you know, I had like this nice amplitude with a good QRS complex. And all of a sudden it just goes like, and it gets super tiny, like the kind of amplitude you see on like a 9-year-old granny who just has like a little, like a weak heart or something. Like it just went from big, beautiful QRSs to like itty bitty little tiny ones.
Hey guys, I'll get back to the episode in just a second, but I wanted to pause to let you know that if you love my podcast, but wish there were more of these awesome episodes, well, I have great news for you. There is more. My Rapid Response Academy is basically podcast 2.0, plus the huge added bonus of community. I love hosting this podcast, but it's just me recording into a microphone often by myself. And this extroverted gal who loves to both teach and mentor nurses just wanted more. So in the community I created, I get to teach live every Friday and break down topics that I think every nurse needs to know. From deep dives into the pathophys of every emergency you can think of, to some of the heart of nursing topics as well, like how to advocate with confidence for your patient, how to de-escalate situations, how to deal with bullies on the unit, how to be an amazing preceptor and charge nurse, and some of the mindsets and boundaries that have helped me stay in nursing for the last 20 years, not burn out, and thrive at the bedside. I love the opportunity to answer your questions live, and it's such a joy to see nurses supporting each other in this community. So, if you're an acute care nurse that wants to expedite your growth as a nurse and invest in yourself so that you can provide the best care to your patients, you would love my Rapid Response Academy. So to learn more, I put a link in the show notes for you. Hope to see you there. So what are you thinking? You're like, what happened to the leads?
I was like, I've never seen that before. I have no idea. I mean, I'm like standing right there. The patient is perfectly still and he's got the leads on. Nothing has moved. So like, this is an internal change. But I went out, I told the doctor, I was like, the amplitude just changed on the cardiac monitor. Like, I have no idea why. So he comes in, he reassesses the patient and the patient's just got crepitus all over his chest. So there's just air in all the wrong places.
Oh my gosh. Can you see it? Like, does his chest look physically bigger?
It wasn't noticeable.
Okay.
But right. You could palpate it.
So what are we thinking was the source of this change in amplitude on the QRS complexes?
We did chest x-ray right after that. It's like his fourth one of the day. And we found that he had a pneumoperitoneum. So basically the pressure from trying to intubate these really, really stiff lungs, We lost that battle and the barotrauma caused some kind of perforation. So now air from the lungs going into all the wrong places.
Yeah. Okay. So at this point, like, what are your options at your facility?
Panic. No. At this point, we started initiating a transfer because, like I said, I work at a small community hospital. We don't have cardiothoracic surgery. We don't have any of the big fancy stuff. So once we know he has a pneumoperitoneum, they start setting up the transfer for him to go to our affiliate hospital that has way more resources.
But like, that takes a while. It'll just like pop in your back door as soon as you want him to be there. Like, how long does that yeah. process usually take to get a bed and to get a flight crew or a ground crew to show up at your door?
Yeah, luckily we're a ground, like we just need ground transportation and we're pretty like physically close to this hospital. So once they decided that, I think they were there within like an hour. It wasn't too terribly long, but that hour was all it
took.
The long hour. Yeah. Yeah. The longest yeah. hour.
Okay. All right. So the transfer's underway. Mm-hmm. Then what? What are you doing with this super sick guy with the pneumoperitoneum and like super low tidal volumes?
Yeah. So once he had the pneumoperitoneum, we were planning to paralyze him. So we were going to do a Nimbex drip. So we got that set up. We're paralyzing him. We added a ketamine drip for sedation. So we were doing ketamine, propofol, and then he was on the Presidex, but the plan was just to kind of wean that one off because we really wanted the ketamine and the propofol. So he's on ketamine, propofol, nicardipine, and Nimbex. Oh, and a bicarb drip. And we had done like, I don't know, 6 ounces of bicarb.
You were a busy nurse that day. This is like this is like the depths of ICU nursing.
I'm getting something else ready. I walk in the room. All of a sudden, his blood pressure tanks. So we turn off the nicardipine drip. And the doctors are coming in the room and we were planning to put these chest tubes in. So they're at bedside setting up with chest tubes. And then doc's like, go get a Levofed drip because his pressure is tanking. So I'm going to grab Levofed. We're pulling the crash cart close by. And all of a sudden he arrests.
Wow. So you go from nicardipine drip to get the blood pressure down to trying to rapidly mix up a norepinephrine drip to get the blood pressure up.
Yeah.
And then cardiac arrest. Okay. So we're in cardiac arrest. We're following ACLS. How did that go?
The doc was immediately like, as soon as we, you know, realized what was happening, he was like, I need needles to do like a bilateral decompression. So I ran out of the room. I'm getting the needles for him because we're not a trauma center. So we don't have that stuff like in a resuscitation room. We got to go and get it from the back.
Rummage in a drawer somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. So I come back with the needles. They had done like, you know, a round or two of CPR, a round or two of epi. And then we pause CPR for just a moment and he does the bilateral decompression. And we get like a nice big puff of air out of like the right side of the chest. So the patient had a tension pneumothorax and that's why he arrested. Because I guess the pneumoperitoneum can then lead to the tension pneumothorax.
Yeah, I mean, that and just having such bad asthma. Yeah, he was mm-hmm. so hyperinflated and mm-hmm. you just like, we couldn't like get ahead of it, right? We couldn't get that out. And so eventually it's going to be too much pressure and something's going to pop. And that's exactly what happened. Okay. So needle decompression, were you able to get a pulse back after that?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think we did like half a round of CPR just to kind of get things going and his pulses came back right away. And, you know, he was in a Brady PEA, which, you know, makes you think like his heart's probably trying to beat. There's just no room in there to actually like create a pulse because it was getting squeezed.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So you got a pulse back. Did he finally get, did transport come?
Transport came. They showed up outside of the room like a minute before he arrested. So they got to witness all the action.
Oh, so you had extra bodies. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah. So he arrests. It's, you know, pretty short and quick. The needle decompression fixes him. And then we go right ahead. And luckily, you know, we had two docs there and he was by far the sickest patient. So they both got to be in the room and then we just popped both of his chest tubes in and wrapped them all up and were getting him ready to go to the big hospital with all of the fancy resources.
Wow. Brooklyn, what a shift. I mean, like, goodness gracious, like all the worst case scenarios happened with this asthmatic and you were just like on top of it every single time. Did you ever get to hear back how he did once he transferred out?
Yeah. So I'll just say real quick, we did like the ABG right before they transferred him out and his pH had, you know, worsened. He just arrested. So his pH was 6.7. His CO2 finally did start to improve. But basically, his pH was so bad, they had our doc ride downtown with him because they were like, he's at such risk of just arresting again. So our doc rode downtown with him and they took him right to the OR and set him up for ECMO. And then we found out kind of like later on that he had actually been intubated 5 times before. So that, you know, kind of made the picture make a little more sense as to why we were just on such a disastrous path from the get-go. But he ended up spending 3 weeks, I want to say, on ECMO. I think it took like 7 days for his lungs to even start like responding to treatment and start opening up. And then he had some complications when they tried to wean him off sedation and he pulled out a chest tube. That kind of prolonged things. But last I heard, he was getting discharged to rehab.
Wow. Yay.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So a couple of things that I would like to highlight, and then I kind of want to hear your feedback as well. First off, I feel like a lot of the education that comes out from these like
big academic centers. And we're like, yeah, and you just grab the 12-gauge needle out of your pocket and you don't decompress like we do. Or yeah, you just go ahead and throw them on ECMO real quick. Like,
yeah.
It is a whole different rodeo when you're working community hospital, or even like a critical access hospital in the middle of nowhere.
Okay.
Limited resources, being like less people, less equipment, like it's a whole different world. And so it's a whole new set of challenges. And so I just want to highlight the awesome work you guys did at responding to this patient, trying to be proactive, like doing all the things. But yeah, the one thing you didn't have was a cardiac surgeon and ECMO. That was his only hope. You know, like you literally had tried all the things possible for him. And that was his only hope. So I'm so glad at least he was able to get there and get what he needed. So in summary, props, awesome job getting this patient what he needed. I'm so glad that he lived. But man, what a hell of a shift for you. So when you think back about this day, like what are you proud of? What do you feel like went well?
Yeah, I mean, this was like the sickest patient I've probably ever taken care of. And also like one of the younger ones too. And so like the emotional toll of taking care of such a young person who was so sick was just a very different experience for me.
But when you think back to that day, what do you feel like went well? Like, what are you proud of? What did your team do that you're like, yeah, like we did what's right by that patient?
I'm so proud that like he lived and that we were able to get all of those interventions set up for him. I guess that's the first time I've ever like done like those sequence of things for sure. Like I've never transferred someone to ECMO before. And I'm not an ICU nurse, I'm an ER nurse. So I like that was just such a different experience to be taking care of a really sick patient for the entire day. Like I'm used to like, we get him in, we do the initial stabilization and we get him out. So the emotional toll, like the draining, how draining that was just so different. And then also, you know, the whole day I'm like, oh, hey, like, what are we missing? What else can we do? Like, if I was an ICU nurse, what would I do right now? Trying to figure out, like, you know, how to best manage his care, like with the resources that we had was a big challenge. I'm proud that I just survived that shift with him.
From what I'm hearing, you should be very proud of yourself and your team. So strong work. He survived. And man, what a challenging, challenging patient. And then when I have cases like this, you know, they stay with me forever. I've had these types of cases too. And I think about them for months, years. And I'm always looking back, like, okay, is there anything, like if I had the same exact thing happen again, is there anything I would have done differently or like thought through? Because obviously hindsight's like the best teacher. Is there anything looking back that you guys could have done differently?
So one of the things that we had kind of discussed after, and the, one of the things that we realized was a resource we could have utilized was Heliox, because that would have like reduced his work of breathing and maybe helped us stave off intubation a little bit longer, or helped us like maximize him. So when he was intubated, we could have gotten better oxygenation, you know, even though we had less lung volume to work with.
Gotcha. Yeah. And the Heliox, it's like sometimes yes, sometimes no. The thing about it is the Heliox is not 100% FiO2. And so if he's already requiring a lot of FiO2, Heliox is a ratio of helium to oxygen. And so he's not getting 100% oxygen with the Heliox. So sometimes it's helpful, but sometimes it's like we're past that. It's hard to say, you know, if that would have helped or not, but you're right. Something to consider. The other downside of Heliox is sometimes it's hard to get a hold of. Like at my hospital, you have to like go outside and like to this like special storage facility to get them. They're not just like hanging out in the ER.
Yeah.
Ready to go.
It's like these like 6-foot tanks that they got a wheel from the other side of the hospital that I didn't even know
exactly.
We had.
You're like, they're crashing. Grab the Heliox. Outside around the corner, like 3 blocks away, whatever it is. Like, so yes, it's not always the most practical, but it's definitely something to think about in the future. Could we switch things around to where it's more available, or we have more education about it, whatever the thing is, where it might be an option. Okay, good. And then thinking back, whenever you sat down with your preceptee afterwards, what were like the takeaways that you wanted her or him to know? Like what wisdom or guidance would you give to any nurse that's managing an asthmatic patient?
Yeah, as far as managing an asthmatic patient, which it's so funny because the week before that, we had an asthmatic patient on BiPAP. And then the week before that, we had a patient with a chest tube. So this was a really nice buildup to this really critical patient that she got to see. But takeaways wise, I mean, I thought I, you know, had it good amount of experience with that. And it's like, all right, we got to be aggressive with the sedation so they can tolerate the vents so that we can oxygenate them well. And usually the ones that I've intubated before, like, you know, we get them turned around with the ET tube and then, you know, they go to the ICU and they can get weaned, you know, a couple hours, a couple days later. So that was like the only advice I had was like, oh, yeah, okay. So what, we got to be aggressive with the sedation.
And that's good advice. That is good advice.
Yeah, but I think assessment-wise, like his physical assessment was just so different than a lot of the patients that we had been assessing. So I was like, you know, when I was auscultating for placement, I was like, oh my God, listen, like you can hear that we're moving so little air. And you can see on his chest that we're not getting chest rise and chest fall. He's just quivering. And at that point, like, you know, when our respiratory therapists were trying to ventilate him, they were doing like a pressure setting. So basically it wouldn't let the vent go past a certain pressure to try and avoid the barotrauma. But that was only letting us move about 30 cc's of air into and out of his lungs, which thank goodness he was a young kid because he was somehow sounding okay with that little tidal volume.
That's crazy. And like, what a great way to like bring all the pieces together for this new grad. Like you hear in nursing school, okay, tidal volume, I kind of get the concept, but to see like, oh, a tidal volume of 40, that's what it sounds like. Oh my goodness, no wonder he's so sick, right? It just makes so much more sense when you can see it in real life and kind of put all the pieces together. So what a great experience for them too. Well, Brooklyn, again, strong work. He survived. You survived. Next week on the podcast, I'll be coming back to break down all of these things. I'm going to go through all the things in the toolbox, the rationales behind them, what the dosages are, why do we do it this way? Because there's so many nuggets of learning wrapped up into this great case. So thank you for sharing with me on Instagram. And thank you for sharing it with all of my listeners now. I so appreciate it. Thank you for being a nurse and for sharing your experience with everybody else.
Thanks so much for having me. I feel like this case was just really worth sharing. So I hope you guys all learned something and thanks for listening.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brooklyn.
Before you go, I just wanted to let you know that if you like this episode, you would probably like my course too. My 1-hour rapid response and rescue course is an introduction to how I approach emergencies. If you would like to learn to think, assess, and respond quickly when your patient is crashing, then you can check out my website, rapidresponseandrescue.com. And if you message me the word podcast on Instagram, I will send you a coupon code for $10 off the cost of the course. Oh, and did I mention that the course is approved by the AACN and worth one continuing education contact hour? So if you want to level up your emergency response skills and get one CE in the process, then this course is what you want. I put the link in the show notes for you. Well, thanks for listening. I hope you learned something that will save a life. Remember, nursing is a team sport, so trust your intuition and don't give up advocating until you are confident you've done what's right by your patient. The views and opinions expressed on this show are that of Sarah Lorenzini and hers alone. They are not intended as medical advice and should not take the place of your institution's policies or procedures. Evidence-based practice is ever-changing, and your patient care should reflect the current best practice. If you want to get in contact with Sarah, you can find her at rapidresponseandrescue.com or on social media platforms as The Rapid Response RN.